Buddhist Summer School Lecture, Tuesday, 30th August 1966, on Wisdom and Compassion. We humans have a body evolved out of the animal kingdom. Its heritage includes the fruits of the conflict embodied in the phrase, the survival of the fittest. All our knowledge about it is material. The spiritual, the transcendent, is the unknown, the infinite. It cannot be brought into the field of the known. It cannot be held in the measure of the finite. By the fading away of this, that, the immeasurable, is. Then its eternal light shines unobstructedly through a transparent this. By the fading away of all knowledge, wisdom works. We, as creatures who are self-consciously separate, will never know truth. Yet it is the truth alone which transmutes us. Our task is to awaken. The living body has a pleasure-pain mechanism. The brain receives impulses, pleasurable or painful, and responds accordingly. With more than a million years of development, this brain has grown into an extraordinarily subtle and complex organ possessed of marvelous faculties. One of these is memory. Unfortunately for us, the mind is corrupted by the memory of pleasure and thus becomes the slave of desire. This mind is the desiring, conceiving mind. Memory makes the mind hark back again and again to the past, which is modified or developed with the assistance of imagination, and again we are hot on the scent of further sensational excitements. But the past is dead. The resuscitation of the past means that a degenerative habit of mind is formed. So the mind stagnates, becomes dull and stupid, often criminally stupid. The mind is the slayer of the real. Let the disciple slay the slayer, says the Book of the Golden Precepts. Looking backward upon the past is complemented by speculative imagining about the future. These backward and forward glances help to build up the illusion of the continuity of a postulated entity called the self, who is supposed to grow, develop, control, direct, purify, reincarnate, tread the path and reach nirvana, etc. This postulated entity, the I or the ego, is the one that sometimes says, I am not my body or thoughts or emotions, but an integral part and parcel of an immutable, eternal, ultimate reality. This postulate, found in various religions, is contradicted in Buddhist teachings. But many Buddhists actually behave and live just as the ego holders do. This illusory I is set up over and against the organism, the temporary changing pattern in the becoming process. Thus, from within ourselves originates the subject-object duality of I the subject and my organism the object, together with all its conflicts. The mind is the villain of the piece. So successful is this villain that we say of this erotic errant mind that it is a rational, perceptive, wise and compassionate, or that it can become so. But the mind is concerned with self-preservation, with ego continuity. Therefore it sets up goals and ideals, and lays down paths and invents techniques to fulfill these goals and ideals. Every thought-made, mind-projected ideal or goal is only an ego projection. Every method or constraining discipline produces an intensification of the self-center. This self-center can be concretized into an almighty God sitting on a throne, or a Brahma breathing out and breathing in vast universes. But all these dear celestial folk are in trouble, in dukkha, as the Buddha pointed out in the Brahmajala Sutta. All the ideas, knowledge, memories, imaginations, forethoughts, preoccupations and plannings of the mind have a proper sphere of activity, namely, the mechanical process of everyday material and cultural life. But all the activity of the duality perpetuating mind blinds our third eye, the eye of wisdom. This conceiving, desiring mind, this chatterbox of which we are so vainly proud, is indeed the slayer of the real. And what is so much nearer and meaningful to us, the spoiler of our humanity, the assassin of love. Now, in relation to wisdom, the business of the mind is not to interfere with complete attentiveness to the totality of life here now. Wisdom is not a bundle of thoughts or verbal statements concretely embodying formless, mysterious, transcendental things called truths. We cannot search for wisdom or acquire it. But when we are fully awake to what is here and now, namely, our illusions and delusions, pleasure or pain, joy or grief, the room, the event, then we are wise. Or wisdom is unobstructedly active in us. This Mahaprajna is not something we can hold in our fists, for this direct seeing of reality is a limb of enlightenment, a no-thing. Truth, in the religious sense, is the intense white-hot awareness of the living total what is, as it changes from moment to moment. It is the shunyata phala samadhi of the Buddha. Now, contrast science or worldly knowledge with religious knowledge, avidya or not seeing with vidya or seeing. Science comes within the realm of thought experience, of word thing. It proceeds from the known to the unknown. But this unknown is only a hidden known, playing peep-bo with the accumulated known. It is confined to the realm of the manifest, of mortality. By contrast, unerring insight, prajna, does something quite different. It functions where we do not know intellectually, when we are not looking for an answer which can be related to the already known. Insight sees into, understands directly the inexpressible unknown. Insight meets the totally new, the source of creative renewal. Our pattern-forming mind afterwards gives mental interpretation, verbal or pictorial form, to this direct seeing. Thereupon, the unknown, the unconditioned reality, is constrained into limited conditioned form, into mere knowledge. Thus, esoteric wisdom is stepped down, degraded, into exoteric teaching, mere knowledge, which is but ignorance. Consider how the Buddha extolled going forth from the life of the home into the homeless state. Esoterically, might it not mean going forth from the limitation of the conditioned familiar into the non-conditioned unfamiliar? Does this not signify such total renunciation of the known that self disappears and the immortal transcendent is here now in all the beauty of its all-loving aloneness? Let us consider together what we mean by the known and what we mean by understanding or direct seeing by buddhi. Ordinarily, when the senses function, there is a reaction of tanha, of desire thought, an attraction or repulsion, approval or disapproval, a judgment of good or bad, right or wrong. When desire arises, it arises dually. Consciously, there is a straight statement of the desire, a diction. Unconsciously, there is a contradiction, an urge which says, I don't want it, or I want to be free of the desire. Tanha is the very stuff of conflicting duality. Consciously, the desire is given mental shape by the verbalizing process. That is, it is expressed as a thought form. All our sense observation and all our ordinary thinking is heavily charged with tanha. This binds. It is dukkha. If thought desire is gratified, further desire is bred. If frustrated, resentment, a more aggressive egoistic will to succeed, and desire more than ever on fire is bred. Net result, dukkha. To start with, then, all our ordinary knowledge, thoughts, memories, beliefs, ideas, conclusions, aspirations, ideals, goals, everything contained within our mind box is poisoned or distorted by tanha. All of it is related to a self-center. Thus, when we observe ordinarily, all our observation and what we are pleased to call intellectual understanding is vitiated from the start rotten at its very core. Our ordinary observation and our intellectual understanding are not worth the name of mindfulness or of understanding. This intellectual understanding is the bond slave of the dead past. It is an automatic repetition machine, uncreative, unteaching, unhealing. It has its place only in the realm of the conditioned, of dukkha. What we often call intuition, understanding by feeling, is similarly vitiated. This feeling is also a mental process, a hidden thought or non-verbalized process. Like intellectual understanding, it is under the sway of desire. It is of the dead past, or shall we say, of the dying passing, of the conditioned of dukkha. The apparent movement or progress by the activity of this kind of intuitive and or intellectual understanding is only a modification of the samsaric pattern, only another bed of nails. It is not enlightenment, not freedom. To escape out of this samsaric hellfire, the path was proclaimed by the Buddha, even as the other great teachers proclaimed a path to salvation. In the Noble Eightfold Way, if and when there is samasati, perfect mindfulness, and samasamadhi, perfect communion, in which the total mind is silent, the unconditioned understanding which is unerring insight, buddhi, omniscience, comes alive. This is the seeing of the enlightened one, his vision, his samadhi. This is the plenum flashing throughout the void as light. In his first sermon, the Buddha repeatedly affirms, then light arose, vision arose. For he has seen through all appearances, and his self, Siddhartha Gautama, transfigured, has dissolved into the transparent reality. But now, before you begin to pelt along on the path with a redoubled energy, eager to enter nirvana with a bound, or to acquire a jackpot of merit as a consolation prize, listen to the Prajna Paramita. Subhuti is questioning the Lord. O Lord, is enlightenment attained through an unproduced dharma? No, Subhuti. Is then enlightenment attained through a produced dharma? No, Subhuti. Is then enlightenment attained neither through a produced nor through an unproduced dharma? No, Subhuti. How then is enlightenment attained? Enlightenment is attained neither through a path nor through a no path. Just the path is enlightenment. Just enlightenment is the path. Consider with love, for love makes wise. What quality distinguishes the teachings of all the great teachers? Is it not the utter originality of the presentation of truth, And remember that originality is not the logical or inevitable consequence of following known paths. This originality, in the religious context, is quite different from a thinker's thoughts, however original they may be. Thoughts are like inanimate things, at best only samsarically inspiring, splashing in the mud of dukkha. Contrasting with thoughts, which are but congealed mental patterns, the presentation of the truth is the living word of the Holy One, and this word, his speech, is prophecy. It is like this. If I present you today with a frying pan as a token of my affection for you, you will use it again and again to make an egg and tomato dish for me each time I come a-visiting you. Same old saucepan for dishing me up a meal. Such is the thought of the thinker, a repetitious dishing up. But if I hold you to my heart and kiss you with the transparent light of passion because of pure love, that kiss cannot be stored up to be used again next love day. There is a new kiss for the new day. The old has completely gone, not lost, but become part of you with a deathlessness that is trackless. Such is the word of the Holy One. You will say, but the words of the Holy Ones have been stored up for thousands of years and are repeated and are used again and again. Yes, unhappily, the words of the Holy One are so used as mere words. But I am talking about the prophetic word, the Logos, which is the divine conceiving, the unlimited transcendence in the holy mind, before it is fossilized as a series of linguistic sounds. The Holy One himself is the path, a pure path. We ourselves are also paths, muddy, stony paths. The prophetic word of the Holy One is a finger of living light illumining the path, the invisible truth. Our minds lay down the bricks of our thoughts and ideas and cement them with the rigidities of our uncompassionate ignorance. We lay down paths, not so the trackless Tathagatas. We talk about different paths to perfection meeting at the summit. But do these paths go up a mountain to a summit? Or do they, once formulated, simply go round and round? What, perchance, is the significance of the bhikkhu's processional path encircling the great stupa at Sanchi? There is no pathway up to its crowning umbrella, 54 feet above the ground, which stands inviolate. Is not a summit touched by him who breaks free? Did not Gotama break free of his home? Did not all the holy ones break free of all their bonds without misdirected violence, but simply by direct seeing? Surely the summit is here now, not at the end of a path, for all ends are dead ends. The here now is eternal being, that universal rhythmic pulsating which is samsarically experienced as alternating birth-death. Surely, the summit means the highest intensity of awareness. It means being fully awake. When there is enlightenment, then the new, the unknown, is present. This unknown is the radiant shrine, dark with excessive bright, for you, the person, are no more. The transformed you, Avalokita on high, as the Prajnaparamita has it, sees directly that the form is void and the void is form. You see that the path is no path, nirvana is samsara, and appearance is reality. For you are free of thought coverings. Like all objects which are intruders in space, all thoughts are intruders in universal mind. All states of consciousness are intruders in pure attention. How significant are Manjusri's words to Sariputra in the Prajnaparamita. Enlightenment is not discerned by anyone, nor is it fully known, nor seen, nor heard, nor remembered. It is neither produced nor stopped, neither described nor expounded. Insofar as there is any enlightenment, O Sariputra, that enlightenment is neither existence nor non-existence. For there is nothing that could be known by enlightenment, nor does enlightenment fully know enlightenment. Sariputra asks, has the Lord then not fully known the realm of Dharma? And Manjusri answers, the Lord has not fully known the realm of Dharma. For the realm of Dharma is just the Lord. O Sariputra, if the realm of Dharma was something that had been fully known by the Lord, then the realm of non-production could be stopped. But the realm of Dharma is just the same as enlightenment, for the realm of Dharma is devoid of existence. Non-existent are all dharmas. That is a synonym of enlightenment, and it is thus that the realm of Dharma calls to be called so. For, as the domain of the Buddha, all dharmas are non-separateness. How shall we see directly, without the darkening interposition of our ideas and beliefs, and the suffocating smoke of our desires and delusions? How shall we fulfill the Buddhas in the seeing, only the seen, only in the hearing, only the heard, etc. First, remember, there is no thing to see, no sound to hear. Wisdom begins with purified senses. Let us be wholly mindful of the entire changing situation. See, hear, touch, etc., without any attachment or aversion, approval or condemnation. Do this without letting recognition, recognition, of what is being seen or heard, felt or thought, interfere with the mindfulness. This is extremely arduous. But if we do this, we are free of the clutter of the dead past. Our mind is now spacious. It is free, and so it observes anew, as if for the first time. It observes without any conflicts whatsoever, because we are not taking sides, choosing this as against that with respect to all that is observed. When we observe thus, our seeing and hearing and feeling will be full of dancing delight, the sheer joy of the pure activity of the senses, free of tanha, free of karmic debt, free of illusions. We must not exclude anything from our observation, nor make frantic efforts to include everything, for either exclusive concentration or grasping concentration sets up conflicts. We must be fully sensitive to everything, observe effortlessly, and live by letting live. You may say, but if I merely look and retain nothing, extract no essence, disregard all the past as you suggest, I shall simply be empty-headed. What good is that? What headed are we now? When we observe purely with full attention, we are experiencing at our intensest. This experiencing gives us self-knowledge, that is, knowledge of the ways of the self. With pure observation, there is full understanding of what is observed. The vision is direct. The understanding is perfect. Because there is experiencing at its intensest. Therefore, the experience, which is the form given by memory after the event to experiencing, dissolves away. And also, most important of all, the self-conscious experiencer, that blockhead, the I, is no more. Understanding comes not by authority. The sweet bud of understanding is nipped by the cruel frost of authority. Understanding comes not in course of time, of psychological time. Understanding flashes in the still interval between two awarenesses, in the total silence of the mind, which is calmly spacious. This silence is timeless, quite beyond psychological time, for psychological time is the conflict of desires, contradictions, of choosing this against that. This silence is not engineered. It is the soundless tone, the rhythmic pulse of nature's being, whose eternity transcends all duration. In this silence, the mind does not decay. It is free of decrepitude through time and deadly death. The body moves on into death the consummator, for the body comes within the orbit of chronological time, which lays desolate the universe. The Buddha dies aged 80, but 80-year-old Siddhartha Gautama dies an ageless, undying Buddha, the ever-virgin youth. With the silence of the mind and the flowering of understanding, you cease to do evil, and you cease to pursue good. For you who have gone thus, like Avalokita on high, clearly see that if you resist a thought or feeling out of condemnation, or if you are attracted through a proving choice, you will never understand it. But if you observe it unresistingly and follow it to its very end without indulging it in any way, you will have unerring insight into it, together with full compassion, Mahaprajna and Mahakaruna. And this Mahakaruna, this love grown wise through infinite pity for each and every one in suffering, compels you, the truth finder, to answer the distress call of your fellow man. And so you speak the word. Your communication has to use thoughts, conceptual patterns, words. So, there is a stepping down of truth, a sin. Loving too well, you sin. But love must sin thus, although the penalty is death. Yet the wise one, knowing that death is love's redeeming power, sins wisely and endures a wise, knowing death. Is not the myth that the Bodhisattva in the Tushita heaven comes down into the womb of the Lady Mahamaya, a name which means the great illusion, intended perhaps to teach us love's redeeming power by means of a wise, knowing, that is, deliberate, death? With the stepping down of the truth, for some a god, and for some a dharma, comes into formal being and all the grind of it. A path to salvation is laid down, and its interminable treadmill with a hope and a promise and a reward and an attainment at the end of it. Oh, the futility and the misery of it all! But this Valhalla of the gods, built for the ones fattening through the self-becoming, ego-expanding process, built by backward giants slavishly toiling for the wretched fruits of lust and power, is doomed to fiery destruction when at last transcendent love indraws a projected ego-self into its own egoless, thingless, and thoughtless eternity. Because of Mahakaruna, it is said that the Bodhisattva vows not to enter Nirvana till all beings have entered, and some say till every blade of grass has reached its salvation. This is senseless if taken literally in the worldly context of chronological time and a self-becoming process. But because of your samasati, this opaque stuff which is the you is now wholly transparent to Nirvana, which always remains unknown by mind consciousness. Now perhaps we can see that when you enter Nirvana, all beings also enter Nirvana. you having undergone a transmutation, a new dimension of being and consciousness is made available for all mankind. Or we may say that when nirvana touches you, nirvana touches every being. Only you are sensitive to the touch, for you are awake. The others, insensitive, shrug it off. We can also see that because all beings have not, on their own, entered nirvana, you are said to stay out of nirvana, for you are the compassionate one. The great compassion wells out when, without false self-identification with things and people, your mindfulness makes you disappear. One of the psychic powers the Holy One has. What might this mean? One summer day in 1963, I was sitting at ease in the garden, effortlessly paying attention. The birds sang of the joy of creation, not knowing nor caring that death lurked round the corner. Flies settled on dung and perhaps carried disease, but the bright gold sun shone in their wings and green bodies and flashed heavenly light into my soul. And I knew that Surya and Agni and all the Vedic gods, and Zeus and Apollo and all the Olympians, and Elohim and whatever creative agencies there are, made the dung and the fly, and the flower and the ox, and you and me. And I knew we are not just the evolutes of fertilized ova. We are the heirs of the gods, the divine powers of the supreme mystery whence proceeds this all, this infinite variety of forms veiling the mystery. Also I saw that we, the ephemeral forms of a moment, a year, a lifetime, or of an aeonian world age, we are but the swift-moving, ever-born, ever-dying flickers of energy transformations and changes of pressure and temperature, of form and feeling and word and thought, of hunger and thirst and decay and death, of pain and pleasure and grief and joy, and storm and peace. And we know moments too deep for speech or act. And then we love the flower and the beast and the earth and man and devil and God. And imagine we see the beginning and the end of the world and our fate and the ineluctable will that sweeps us to an unimagined bourne. And sometimes fancy we have met salvation by grace or received enlightenment in beatitude. But they, Varuna and Indra and the powers before the throne that made this all, they said, "It is we, the sovereign lords, who fulfill the behests of the Nameless One through all that is felt and known by you. Your sorrows and successes and confusions and consummations are but the puny expressions of us, the great universal powers that play out your little dramas on the world stage." And I knew that this was true. Yet I also knew that they, the sovereign lords, had but a wistful knowledge of my certainty. For my certainty came not only from outside, grew not only from within. It was there before the world was, hidden in the night of sleep till the dawn of awakening. And that golden daybreak glowed with sweet and silent laughter, when the still mind spoke its wordless message, promising redemption to the powers that toil without Sabbath, making, preserving, and moving this vast world, redemption through one man's enlightenment through wisdom, peace through compassion, freedom through that beauty in which self is non-existent. Thus it is that you disappear. And so, with the unity of life unmarred, the fountains of compassion flow free. You cannot develop compassion. You cannot acquire Mahakaruna, but you can pay attention every fleeting moment to the total changing present. Follow your every thought and feeling without resisting it till it comes to the end. This is the end of all karma, all sorrow along that line. Follow the movement of your failure, your sorrow, your fear, so that you reach utter loneliness. Don't move. Stay with that loneliness, one of the last refuges of separate self. Pay attention only, do nothing till its very end. Your self-heart will then be transmuted into the heart which is love. But you will first know the reality of death. Let death be. He is your agent of transmutation. And if you just let death be, he will restore you to eternal union with life abundant. And the flow of this life is the stream of compassion. If you let death be, wholly attentive to him, all dukkha is transmuted, and the immeasurable void is present. Your loneliness is extinguished forever, and you are henceforth the alone. By virtue of this Mahakaruna, this love, which undergoes continuous healing death through your complete attention to the all this, you will release Mahamudita. You will see the original face of all things and all creatures and all people. You will see them all transfigured, for you will have the blessedness of seeing eternal beauty smiling through the million faces that she shows, the million garbs that she wears for your eternal delight. And your heart will be alight with Mahamudita, transcendent joy. Your silent stillness, Upekha, will be the throbbing heart of love, ever renewing the eager pulse of life. For life is perpetual movement, transcendent action. It never arrives. It never reaches a fixed goal. For the fixed goal is a stagnant endpoint, irreconcilable with life which is eternally creative. Its moving finger writes on the edge of the eternal mind, and laughingly erases the old word as it writes the new. The eternal mind itself is ever empty, spacious, silent. May each and every one of us be thee alone, like a star in the silent solitude of the infinite.